owns Media Corporation, and it really has taken away the independence of a lot of these publications. And naturally, in the digital age, paper readership is down. That's just going to be the case. And that's okay because there are so many avenues to get information to people digitally. A lot of people do still really want to read the written word, even if it's online, myself included. There's also a whole cohort of people who are voraciously consuming podcasts, also myself included. I'm not sure. Maybe I need to spend more time in quiet or something, but I like to consume media a lot. Then there's the people who are consuming news from oftentimes reputable reporters on TikTok, and this is just the nature of the modern age. I think that certain publications are slowly but surely coming around to that. Like, I know that the New York Times is creating more of a digital ecosystem than it ever has before. And when you subscribe to the New York Times, you get access to bonus podcasts on Spotify and things like that. So, in one way, it's just the natural order of things. And I think it's pretty cool that reporters are kind of scaling down, being more independent, and really taking the power back into their own hands.
Yeah. What's one thing that you're most proud of what you've reported on?
Well, I recently published an article on CNBC that focuses on how digital hiring assessments that people often have to take in order to even get to an interview stage in a company are largely not accessible for people with disabilities, despite the fact that many of them say they are. And I was able to speak to people with various disabilities, people who consult on this issue, people who research this issue, and figure out maybe what the next step is and why we need to restructure the digital hiring process. The interesting thing about that is that the Americans with Disability Act this year will be 30 years old. It wasn't until the last couple of decades that we've been living vastly online. And hiring online is even more recent. So a lot of these problems that people face who have disabilities are actually newer, even though there is accessibility in a lot more ways than we maybe have known in the past. There's kind of new ways that we have to fight against bias as well.
That's so interesting. So, what is the advice that you'd give to so a young person, maybe someone in college like me, who might be interested in going into journalism?
My advice is that even if you feel like you don't have the expertise to be reporting on something, just go for it anyway and ask a lot of questions. People get really excited when they're given the opportunity to answer questions, even if they might not seem like it at first. All you have to do is say, "I'm a reporter. Can I ask you some questions for such and such?" Usually, they let their guard down pretty quickly, even if there is a hesitancy at first, and it ends up working out really well. I would say don't be afraid to push the status quo and ask the hard questions. I feel like a lot of the advice I'm giving is just don't be afraid, don't be afraid. But despite the fact that the college experience gives you an opportunity to step outside of the box and try new things, there are ways that that opportunity may also try to confine you to pursue a certain path. And you really don't have to do that path if you don't want to. You can choose your own. And there's more options now than ever. You can work fully online, you can work remote from a post in Bali if you want. You don't have to do that forever, but I think it's, after college, it's always a good time to try something like that. I'll just say, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. My name is Rachel Curry. I'm pretty active on there. I do have my newsletter called Acronym, which I'll be posting about all the time. And if you feel like you have a lead for a story, feel free to send me a message.
Thank you. This has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Rihanna Duncan, and I've been interviewing Rachel Curry. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue here on WRCT Pittsburgh. On May 7th of 2024, I had the privilege of interviewing bassist Ron Carter, right around the time he turned 87 years old. And before I share the conversation we had, let's play a number from his catalog. This is from a 2006 record where he collaborated with guitarist Bill Frisell and drummer Paul Motion. And it's a trio version of a song that Ron Carter wrote with Miles Davis called 81. what a privilege it is to have Ron Carter on the phone with us here on Forbes Avenue. And what you just heard was Ron Carter, Bill Frisell, and Paul Motion playing 81. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Carter.
Good morning to you and yours.
I think that track is really interesting because it's something you co-wrote with Miles Davis, but it comes out totally different in a trio format with Bill Frisell and Paul Motion.
You know, I miss Paul. Paul was a wonderful drummer. He knew melodies, he knew form, he knew dynamics, he knew how to listen. And boy, Drum World misses a wonderful influence on them as he's left the scene. It's always fun to play Bill. It's always fun to hear him. And I try to do that whenever I can to see what I missed last time working with him. a good band.
One thing that's fascinating to me about all of Bill Frisell's work, and for you too, is balancing that written music against the improvisation.
Well, I think two things, Mr. Gordon. We've kind of gotten used to leaving our ego at home, one, and two, bringing both ears to the gig. And if you have that combination, you find nice things to do.
You've played in large groups and led large groups and small groups. You've been in over 2,200 recording dates. What kinds of things stand out to you over the years of experience?
I'm always surprised that the calls I get that are not necessarily jazz bands or jazz-oriented gigs. So that after all the choices that they have, they decided that this guy, me, has the best chance of making their music do something that they hope it can do. All the good players come to New York. That's what we're all about here. And with the travel situation being what it is, it's easy to get to New York in a moment's notice. So that they have chosen me for their projects as a tribute to recorded sounds and social media and stuff like that. But one of the things I've taken away from these concert projects is that we all got the same notes. Mm-hmm. We just find different orders for them, and I try to find them as quickly as I can for the various projects. It's fun to do that.
I get the sense that you're really adept at both leading the gang and being a supportive team member.
Well, you know, I think quietly, Richard, the band's bass player is both of those. He's always the band leader, and he always leads the charge, so to speak. You know, in any group, Richard, he's the only person, he or she, sorry, ladies, they are the only ones who play every note all the time. Mm-hmm. That means they control the tempo, they control the changes, they determine where the beat is, they determine the pitch of the band, they determine sometimes the volume of the band. He or she is the only one that does each note has this kind of effect. And I think once we understand that plural we are able to have even more fun going to work night in and night out, which is why I go to work every night. I like those challenges.
You're 87 years old, and you're still performing and still practicing.
Absolutely. Well, my birthday was May 4. I had some nice friends over to say hello, and I'm glad to see you make it this far, given the world. Well, you know, I can't get better, Richard, unless I'm practicing what I'm aiming for. My general practice plan is I go into my practice room, and I have a goal in mind. What can I learn today playing these etudes that I didn't see yesterday? If I can cover that kind of ground and make up for those kind of missteps, so to speak, I'm really ready to go to work tomorrow night because I really figured out something to do that didn't occur to me the night before.
When you're working on your etudes, I mean, they are divorced from the music you're going to play.
Yeah, but it's still the same notes, they're just in different order, man.
So it's all about getting the tools in those fingers so that when your ears hear what the other guys are doing, you know what to pull out.
I want to be all over it. Absolutely correct.
We are chatting with Mr. Ron Carter. And Pittsburgh, the home of our radio station, WRCT, is a great jazz tradition. I think of musicians like Dwayne Dolphin and Roger Humphreys and George Benson and Ray Brown, Billy Storen, Eric Blakey, David Eisenzahn, and many more. What kinds of memories do you have about either collaborating with Pittsburgh musicians or coming to town to play?
One thing, I miss seeing Dwayne often. If you see him again or talk with him, give him my fondest regards and tell him I miss him.
All right.
Several of my school buddies from Eastern School of Music lived in Pittsburgh. And at one of our summer breaks, I drove from Rochester to Pittsburgh to pick him up and drive back to school. We had hung out for a weekend. 58 or so, Bill Motzing, a trombone player from Pittsburgh, really played really well and wrote nice arrangements. My other view of Pittsburgh is the jazz club that they had there. What's the name of that place?
Was it the Grill?
Yes, Crawford Grill. Back in the day, they had a knowledgeable jazz crowd. They came and have a good time, but hear the music. They always wore the latest fashions. It was like been in New York, only in Pittsburgh. Loved it.
Well, there's still quite a bit of jazz being played in Pittsburgh, and there's even a church that has jazz vesper service every month. Yeah, it's really cool.
I miss Nathan Davis, too, by the way. He was one of my friends from doing the clinics up there for summers. He was promoting the jazz community's music in and around the city. Lovely man. I'm sorry he's left the concert.
What is different for you about playing for a live audience, whether a club or a concert, or going into a recording session?
I guess three main things. The level of sound that's necessary, no matter how good the club is and how good their system is, the studio requires less physical effort to make the sound of the instrument, in this case bass, fill the room space. Mm-hmm. Secondly, given the quality of microphones and as engineers are learning to record the instrument music better, you needn't play so hard and so forcefully, literally, mm-hmm. for the duration of the gig in the studio as you would have to do in a nightclub. And thirdly, generally speaking, you're in a smaller spectator space. Generally, only the band is at the recording studio, so there's no other views or impressions you want to leave on somebody else who's not playing vis-a-vis the audience. In the studio, you're referring to and relaying to the members of the band, the producer perhaps, an engineer. So your focus is limited to five or six people, and it's a lot easier to control that than having your view, your emotional view, your physical view, spread out over a huge room with 2,000 fans.
Has it been your experience that it's easier for the musicians to communicate with each other in a recording session?
Depends on the gear of the studio. Sometimes they have good earphone sets. Sometimes they're prepared to not have any at all. It varies on the situation.
As an amateur bassist myself, I know how important it is to listen and to be able to hear everybody so that, as you say, you can set the pace for them, but also support them in whatever they're doing.
Well, I think a footnote to that, Richard, is that it's important for them to hear me, in this case, me, the bass player.
Right.
Each note I play, and sometimes studios are not geared for that level of bass sounds and notes available to the guys in the band. I've seen some pictures recently of a studio when a quintet was playing in the studio, and they had everyone in the same room. And I think that's not going to be, they can't be productive for the bass player, because given the space they're living with or playing with, no one in this group, no matter how quiet they play, can hear every note he or she plays.
Right.
I kind of demand that, you know, and I know that that situation that they're in right there moment, that's not going to happen. I don't mind note to go to waste. I think it's impactful for all those reasons I mentioned earlier about each note that I played does those things, and I think that they're doing a disservice to the bass player and the musicians when they are unable to not literally hear every note he or she plays.
Sounds to me like you sort of favor the setup where the bass player is in a separate room but with a glass to see the other players.
Yes, and I don't know how much time you have, but I'll tell you exactly why I feel that way. In an open space where the bass player is in the middle of a room with no barriers around him, stacks of glass, the bass tries to fill all the space around it. Mm-hmm. However big the space is, the bass sound fills that whole area. By the time it gets to the microphone, the sound is so diluted because it's been played, it's been ringing around in this room for all this square footage, that the sound cannot be as impactful or as startling and sounding because the sound is delayed, it's decayed, it's dying by the force of the sound. By the time the force of the sound gets to the microphone, whatever quality it is. And I think to have the bass player more isolated in the room, that's a 6x6 room, it forces the sound of the bass, all of the sound, into the microphone that's now only 2 feet away rather than 25 feet away according to the room. No, I'm not a fan of that at all.
That makes good sense. So you always work with a microphone, or do you, when you play live, do you sometimes work through a pickup?
All those factors are varied. Generally, I have a pickup from a David Gage in New York, a realist, that works really good for me. And the microphones, depending on where it's placed, depending on how close I am to the drums, depending on whether the piano lid is up all the way or halfway, all those sounds are feeding to my microphone. And as a bass is only one instrument times four, or whatever size the quintet is, that microphone cannot possibly isolate enough from everyone else's sounds for the bass sound to be more present in his microphone, quote-unquote, his.
We are chatting with Ron Carter, and bassists out there, you're getting a lot of good tips here from Mr. Carter. As a teenager, I know that you switched from classical music to jazz, and I know that you also made a change from cello to bass, and my sense is that the jazz world is much more about can you play rather than are you from the right side of the street or the preferred race. Have you found that that's true, that the jazz community is more welcoming of more kinds of people?
That was the case back in the day. But I think if you take photographs of orchestras, classical orchestras, let's say the big top five orchestras from 1967 to 2024, I think you will see that the proportion of minorities, people of color, the proportion of graduates from classical schools, and the proportion of them in classical orchestras is not much better in that 30 or 40 year span.
Right.
When I was coming up, it was made pretty clear to me that orchestras, while no matter how good I played, the management was not prepared to hire a person of color in those orchestras back then. And my position is, I'm not sure that much of that has changed given the photographs you find on the internet. So having discouraged is a pretty strong word, but that's probably what it really was. A career in playing classical music, the jazz community welcomed me to New York to try to come to New York because all the players end up there. So there I was. I have not forsaken classical music. And if you didn't know my library, I've recorded some jazz classical songs and other. I have a nice classical music library in my home of discs and music. I'm still aware of the music, and I will try to play it whenever I get the opportunity to. Every Christmas, for example, high school orchestras and church orchestras need extra bass players to play the Handel, the Hallelujah Chorus, or they may have a Brandenburg Society that needs bass players during the course of the holidays. I'm always available to those concert groups, and I play as many as I can as my schedule allows and the availability of it. So I have not forsaken them. I still encourage the music. I can endorse anyone who wants to play that. Go ahead and get your feet wet and enjoy what it does for you. I'm the jazz player in the meantime.
That classical background, I'm sure, has influenced the way you approach practicing and the way you approach performing.
Well, I think the biggest influence for me was, Richard, was how to practice. Back then, the competition as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old was stunning. Of all the good players who were already ahead of me in background and experience, and know that I could kind of make those being the big steps so far ahead of me, not so far back, and kind of even the score, was to know what I had to learn during each practice time. So before I sat down to my cello at the time, I'd figure out what do I need to make this practice time allow me to do with more ease, or a new fingering, or better intonation, a better sound. And when my practice time was over at 2 or 3 hours, I'd stop and say, now, what did I learn this past two and a half hours, or whatever it was? Can I remember what that was and translate that to the next practice time the next day? I still had that mindset, Richard.
That's one of the many things that you'd like to share with other musicians. I mean, all these...
Absolutely.
All this knowledge and experiences, and I know you want to help us all learn from your experiences. So you've got a lot of information up at the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
Yeah, well, you know, one of my concerns, Richard, and this is my concern day, I guess, is that the most books that the jazz bass player is studying are built on playing, in this case, bass horizontally and as fast and as rhythmically and clean as possible. And I certainly admire that concept. My books are different than that. I try to teach my students to play as horizontally as possible across the bass, and my exercises are based on chords. Mm-hmm. My feeling, Richard, is that once the student understands harmony and what the chords sound like and what direction the chords are headed, what's the point of this chord going from this chord to this chord, they see the result of that, they'll play the music differently because they understand the harmony behind the influence of these notes being what they are.
That's a very, very good point. And again, folks, you can find that information about the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
All right.
Now, Ron Carter, you are one of my favorite bassists. I think I told your people that you and Charlie Hayden and Slam Stewart and Dave Holland are probably my favorite bassists.
Well, great. I'm in good company.
But you have also been an integral part of some of my favorite jazz recordings. You know, the Herbie Hancock sessions with Cantaloupe Island and Maiden Voyage and so much great work with Miles. But I still love your work in the trios. And one of my absolute favorites is that old record you made, Jazz My Romance, with Kenny Barron and Herb Ellis.
But, you know, I've always wanted to play with Herbie. I've known him for a very long time because I'm an Oscar Peterson fan. And, of course, Ray Brown and Ed Thigpen, he joined the band. And I said, well, my record contract list lasts two more records. I've got to get Herbie on a record, Herbie Ellis. And Kenny Barron was available at the time my schedule opened up, and I was trumping on a bit to try to track down Herbie Ellis and where he was and could he make this record with him. Well, we had such a great fun. He's just a wonderful guy. You know, wonderful sound of the rhythm he used to play, just a killer. And I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Carter.
Rich, good to talk to you. And I'm sure I'll see you in Pittsburgh. Forget to say hello.
And we're going to let the folks hear Sweet Lorraine from that very record, Jazz My Romance.
And please enjoy Kenny Barron. What a diamond he is. Thank you. Thank you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT 88.3 FM. My name is DJ Tony Tunes, and you're listening to From Here to Eternity, that show where we take a trip back to the 80s that you never knew. Well, today, we're going to just, you know, do the usual little mix of some things, but we're going to start off today with a song, because we're in spring right now. You know, I feel like, you know, in the spirit of the general springtime, you know, there really isn't any, I guess, Easter music. So we'll settle for spring. We're going to start off with this song here. It's excellent. I think it was entered into both Sanremo and Eurovision at the time. This is a tremendous song, personal favorite I've had on loop for quite some time. This is Maledetta Primavera by Loretta Goggi. We're going to do that right now.
Stringersi poi, vino bianco, fiori e vecchie canzoni, e si rideva di noi, che imbroglio era, maledetta primavera, che resta di un sogno erotico sei, al risveglio è diventato un poeta. Se a mani vuote di te non so più fare, come se non fosse amore, se per errore chiudo gli occhi e penso a te. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
WRCT 88.3 FM. My name is DJ Tony Tunes, and you just heard Dream by P. Lion. Before that, we had the Air Studio version of Tel Aviv, the one that I think should have made it to the album. That was by Duran Duran, and we started off today with Maledetta Primavera, and that was by our good friend from Italy,
If I have her name, it slips. I always lose it. Loretta Goggi. There we go. But the next one, I wanted to at least play one song by them because I did see them. They were in town over here in D.C. Flock of Seagulls came, and great show. They ended up playing Space Age Love Song twice after the audience was like, yeah, play it again. So that was good, but we're going to do one that didn't get a crazy amount of attention, at least on the charts. This one's going to be The More You Live, The More You Love. I'm going to go into that right now.
Thank you. Come desideri, ti farò un'ora l'anima, ti farò.
WRCT 88.3 FM. My name's DJ Tony Tunes, and right now we're listening to Pink Footpath by Lewis. For that, we had Ochi Brown's Whenever You Need Somebody, the original that was done by the legendary producer trio Stock, Aitken, and Waterman, for it was on the album for which it was titled by Rick Astley. For that, though, we had Un Nodo All'Anima. That was another Italian song. That one was by Bama Labrati. For that, we had The More You Live, The More You Love by A Flock of Seagulls. But before we get back into things, just wanted to let you know a quick couple of things. Firstly, does your child sometimes get headaches, stomach aches when they aren't sick? Those headaches and stomach aches your child gets may be migraine. A migraine is not just a headache. A migraine attack can last for hours or even days, often with sensitivity to lights and sounds or nausea and vomiting. Migraine is more common than you think. 10% of children and 28% of adolescents have migraine disease. Migraine at school can help. Learn more at migraineatschool.org. Parents understand how migraine impacts their children's ability to learn. It can be hard to focus and even mean missing school. But with the right accommodations, they succeed. Every child deserves the chance to flourish in school. Visit migraineatschool.org to learn more. Sponsored by the Coalition for Headache and Migraine Patients. Also, just letting you know that WRCT is supported by Rita's Italian Ice. Rita's offers a variety of frozen treats, including their Italian Ice, made fresh daily with real fruit, available in over 95 flavors. Rita's has several locations throughout the city of Pittsburgh, including a stand at 3712 Fifth Ave near the University of Pittsburgh campus. For more information, visit their website at ritasice.com. Also, if you're interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. Finally, just a couple shows we have here on WRCT. The Angry Young Man. The world is an angry place, and there's an angry young man who's ready to tackle the issues plaguing it head on. Join Anthony Cachon as he talks about issues ranging from current events to policy debates every Friday at 7 a.m. on WRCT. It's been a little bit dead, but it'll be back, I promise. But we also have Kaleidoscope. You can tune into Kaleidoscope, an eclectic hour of music with your very own DJ Kate, Thursdays at 2 p.m., only on WRCT Pittsburgh. Add to the colorful mix by calling in requests. Well, anyways, with that out of the way, I'm going to go back into the rest of our programming.